to define theonomy. I thought I had. Theonomy is that particular group within the church who holds that not only the Ten Commandments, but the and the moral law, but what we might call the civil law of ancient Israel is to be applied today by the modern state. Now, the Westminster Confession of Faith denies that. It simply says it's except to the extent to which it deals with problems in equity. And I don't know how many of you who know law, but equity jurisdiction is what kind of jurisdiction?
Civil law, what is that?
Civil law. Well, the civil law would be described in Numbers and Deuteronomy and to a degree in Exodus and Leviticus.
What I'm able to do is to separate that from ceremonial law.
Well, the ceremonial law is the law of the temple.
Right.
It's the law of sacrifice, the law of the temple. How do you remember how Aaron and Moses should dress, how they should be ready, and how they should cleanse themselves before they. Mm-hmm. That's the ceremonial law.
All right. Now, the civil law would be?
The civil law, well, for instance, the creation of cities of refuge, that's an example I just happened to think of. And if a man commits blasphemy, you should stone him to death.
The guy, the bull that gored.
Yeah, and you go kill that bull.
Basically, the laws that would govern Israel as a nation.
Yes. The civil law is that law which would govern Israel as a nation.
I think I knew before you described it, but do the theonomists carry it out?
What are
they doing?
No, they don't carry it out. Now, again, you must remember that there are differences in the camp of theonomists. I know you do.
They want to go to such extremes? Are they an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth?
At least some of them would even advocate that if a man's daughter was guilty of sexual immorality, that he should stone her, put her to death. Or if children are rebelled against their parents, they should do likewise. That sort of thing.
Well, in that case, you would have to call someone's position like John Warcraft has, and he says he holds by the confession of even being a theonomist.
You hold what?
You wouldn't even hold John Warcraft as being a theonomist.
No, that's why I try to exempt him. Except to the extent to which I'm one, and you're one. I mean, I would suspect most of us are. In other words, I think he's been unjustly accused, to be put it bluntly.
Being a theonomist.
Yeah.
What does he say about it?
I let him speak for himself. I don't want to quote him.
Hey, I was reading a comment on one particular person about some of the scriptural penalties
that's the civil law.
Some of the scriptural penalties.
That's the civil law.
Old Testament penalties, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they brought up the fact that in some cases, you know, like an eye for an eye and all that, that this serves a good purpose, mm-hmm. and that the fact that it set a penalty, whereas people might be inclined to take the law into their own hands and to really do something, and to kill them.
That's correct. Now, this is good. See, I'm not condemning that civil law.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I'm saying, see, that's why I read Exodus 19. These laws were given to make Israel the nation. Distinctive. And when you study ancient history, you can see that they were the only distinctive nature in all the ancient world. We go blithely over these things. We don't realize how different Israel was, even in their sinful days. And they were sinners, and they did terrible things. But they never lost their sense of national identity, either racially or as a nation. And God promised if they come back to him, he'd call them back out of Babylon, back to the Holy Land, back to Israel, and he did. Now, the confession of faith and the scriptures teach that the moral law is to be enforced. But you see, in the sense in which the Old Testament uses Israel, we're not, as a nation, God's peculiar people. In 1 Peter 2nd chapter, we are a peculiar people, a holy nation, a called out generation and so on, and a priest, a nation of priests. Now, Peter was speaking to Gentiles there. He's not speaking to Jews. No, there were Jews in the church. And to the extent to which there were Jews in the church, he of course is speaking to them. But we are the new Israel. You see, the church of the old covenant was largely, not entirely, but largely confined to the nation of Israel. There were people like Nahum, and there were people, others, who came into a conversion experience in Old Testament terminology, and who believed. But ordinarily, that was not the case, because Israel was the beacon light, both politically and ecclesiastically, for the ancient world. Now, you see, in the New Testament church, or the church in the New Covenant, it's an international body. It does not have a home in any one nation. Therefore, those laws which are specifically ordained for Israel as a nation, the Israelites' civil law, is no longer applicable. But the moral law is.
I believe you already told us what the law of equity is.
Yes, the law of equity. Mark, let me rephrase it. Equity jurisdiction is the jurisdiction of any particular court to decide cases where no law covers the situation. Equity means that which is equal, that which is fair, rather than specific, according to either specific constitutional or legislative action. And you'll have courts of equity. And a great deal in Israel was done in a court of equity. And we have courts in which have equity jurisdiction.
Would that be what we would normally call common law today?
No. It can be. Yeah. Equity jurisdiction would apply common law principles. See, today, most of the common law is now statutory law. I was going to take that next. Question?
Online, we were talking about with the moral and the civil law. Mm. Aren't there certain of those laws that fall into both categories?
Yes.
And in that case, isn't there some laws which do carry over? Or is it the one we're talking about, these laws which facilitate itself to the situation today?
Well, they would carry over either in laws of equity or in the common law. I'm speaking of English common law now. Principles of jurisprudence. The average lawyer never gets this. The history of law or the philosophy of law.
Dr. Grant, it seems to me that perhaps the greatest problem we have with regard to this shift from a law based on God's law is court interpretation of even old laws that were adopted under the old
country. I was going to come back later in my discussion, but briefly, the problem which we have now, which has beclouded the issue to such an extent, is sociological law, or law by the majority. The two terms are somewhat different, but they pretty much cover the same thing. You see, practically all judges today, the Supreme Court judges, have advisors, most of whom are sociologists and are trained in sociology, some in psychology, some in psychological sociology, and that sort of thing, sociopsychology. And thus, it is true, and I won't deny it, and nobody else could, that the Supreme Court cannot read with any degree of carefulness all the cases that come before it. Now, what they do, each judge, and I'm talking now to the United States Supreme Court, but it's also true in the North Carolina State Supreme Court, and also in what we have a system of court of appeals. Now, in these situations, each of the nine judges on the Supreme Court has the right to have several law assistants. And now they don't have to be lawyers. Some of them are, but they would be sociologists and social psychologists. So that today, beginning going back to probably the famous Ogden case of 1914, you have the introduction of what you might call sociological law. It really was begun by Oliver Wendell Holmes as a legal writer in 1883 when he wrote The Common Law. But at that time he was not a judge, he was simply a lawyer. But in 1903, Theodore Roosevelt had a very important case coming before him. It was known as the Northern Securities Company case, and it dealt with the attempt of Morgan and others, J.P. Morgan, to merge into one vast railroad system, the Northern Pacific, the Great Northern, and the Chicago, Burton, and Quincy, due to the fact that the Chicago, Burton, and Quincy controlled all the tracks from Chicago to Minneapolis and St. Paul, and that both the Northern Pacific and the Great Northern ran from Minneapolis to the Pacific Coast, and they needed a direct connection with Chicago, which they could control. So they concocted this Great Northern Securities Company case, which would hold the securities of the three railroads and in that way bring them to one system. Now, Roosevelt was very much opposed to it, and he packed the court. He got Oliver Wendell Holmes on the court to tip the court in that favor. Well, the court did rule in favor of breaking up the Northern Securities Company, but Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote a devastating minority opinion, which shattered Roosevelt's faith in him. But he was on the court in 1932. And between 1904 and 1932, he issued a series of decisions, sometimes the majority and oftentimes the minority, in which he set aside the principle of the common law and the constitutional law and decided cases in terms of what he thought was sociological benefit. Now, I have a quote in my theological interpretation, which is from the common law, in which he says, "The common law is only what the court said it is." In other words, he introduced the concept of relativity in law, which, of course, destroyed the idea of law. Now, when he was on the bench, Taft and Wilson had appointed some very able jurists. I mentioned a little while ago Justice Vandeman, I think it did, but also Justice McReynolds, who had been in the early days of Wilson's role. He'd been the Attorney General, and when a vacancy occurred, Wilson made him a justice of the court. And until 1916, Hughes was the chief justice. He retired to run against Wilson in 1916, and later he was reappointed to the court by Coolidge or Hoover. So that the court did not fall under this concept of sociological jurisprudence until, well, I guess it's hard to put an exact date on it, but you can see it in Helbring versus Davis in 1937 and the Roosevelt era. It comes out most clearly in the McCollum, Vashti McCollum versus Champaign School District case of March 1948. Which was the first of the Bible in the school deals, dealing with release time education. And then in the Borshak case in 1952. And then most distinctly in the famous Abington School District case involving prayer in the public school in 1963. And in the Gregg versus Georgia case of 1966, dealing with capital punishment. And the Miranda case, dealing with how the court obtains evidence, And of course, supremely in Roe versus Wade, in the abortion case in 1973, and these many others, and in the Brown versus Kansas School District case, the so-called segregation case didn't have a leg to stand on, constitutionally speaking. Doesn't have anything to stand on. It was and they admit it was a sociological decision.
Seemingly everything that you said this evening implies that as Christians we if we only stand on the confession that that we're going to have to take the position that this is and must be a Christian nation. We cannot go along with it.
Not in the sense of which Israel was, but a Christian nation which it was in the colonial period and the early national period, when the Bible formed and guided the consensus even among non-Christians. Now that is what we, and I think that, if I understand Joe Moorcraft, like I think I do, that is what his aim is. He's under no illusions about having a totally Christian nation, but he's very much in favor of having biblical principles and grafted into the court decision and to the legislative activities, not only of the federal government, of Congress, but of the state. And I completely agree with that.
In other words, our standards are teaching us that we must work toward that aim and not try to live off of the approval of pluralistic society.
That's correct. See, pluralism is wrong. Not in a sense, we can't put the heretics to death, but we made a great, 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 great mistake when the Supreme Court outlawed the voting restrictions, particularly in the southern states. You see, when the Constitution was formed, every state, without exception, had certain types of voting restrictions. Property, you had to own a certain amount of property to be able to vote. You had to own more property to be a member of the state assembly, and you had to have more property to be the governor. And you had to have property to vote for members of Congress or the president. In other words, the voting restrictions applied both to local elections and to federal elections. Now, the result was, of course, that for instance, in North Carolina, you had to be a quote unquote a Bible believing Christian to hold the office of governor or lieutenant governor, and in the assembly, preferably a Presbyterian, but until, say, after 1800, when the Baptist Methodists began to outrun us, and Anglicans. Now, you see, they tolerated all groups. We had Quakers, Moravians, Scotch-Irish, Scotch, Swiss, Germans. We had all these groups, but these churches were tolerated. Jews were tolerated, but that did not give them political privileges. When this was outlawed, they destroyed the fabric of the American civil political system. Now the question is, before I go on, can a government, once they have gotten on the roller coaster of democracy, put the brakes on any time short of the political disaster? In other words, once you've allowed 18-year-olds to vote, once you've allowed everybody in the state to vote, can you withdraw that privilege without in itself creating a revolution? That's a very serious question, because to allow everybody to vote will produce a revolution. To withdraw the vote will also produce a revolution. Now, The revelation may be of a different kind, but there's no way to establish, to avoid ultimate national disaster.
What does the voting age used to be?
In every state, it was 21. In society today, and this is the question to which Harry was leading us, in the society today, what then must be the role of law? Or let me reverse or change the question. What must be the attitude of government toward the law? And let me point out to you Romans 13:1-8. Let every soul be subject unto the higher power. For no power exists but by God. Romans 13:1. I was translating out of the Greek, but it didn't sound familiar. I was taking it out of the Greek. For the sake of time, I'm going to summarize. Romans 13:1-8 teaches some basic truths. One, that all government exists by divine ordination. All government exists by divine ordination. And you say, what? You say, Hitler's government? Yes. You say, Stalin's government? Yes. Divine ordination brings with it the doctrine of common grace. God, in his common grace, divinely ordained all government. Now, I know people have raised and pricked up their ears when I said that. I point out to them that the alternative is sheer anarchy. Now, Hitler did not have anarchy in Germany. Hitler built the Autobahn. He got the Volkswagen company started as a German family car, the people's car. He built the Autobahn in Germany. He reinvigorated the North German Lloyd line. There are some things he did which were lasting and enduring. I'm far from being a Nazi, but at the same time, if all powers are ordained of God, they do perform certain functions. And Hitler did prevent, and as a matter of fact, he rescued Germany from anarchy. One thing you've got to remember is that in 1921, 22, 23, Germany was undergoing a terrible time. They'd exiled the Kaiser. They had robbed Germany of Alsace Lorraine and they had separated East Prussia by the Polish corridor. They had taken the Saar Basin. They had taken other parts of Germany to Poland and the Sudetenland, the German, the Czechoslovakia, and so on. They had despoiled Germany on the mistaken notion that Germany had caused World War I and piled an indemnity on Germany that nobody could pay. Now, the result was that Germany fell into the financial crisis. You think about inflation. I remember a friend of my mother who had been in Germany telling me that when she went to the grocery store in Berlin, she took a market basket and filled it full of trillions of marks and went down and bought a grocery. The mark was so worthless that you couldn't figure out even how many it took to make a cent. And the devastation was widespread. The economic collapse, the financial collapse, and of course, obviously, the whole Weimar Republic collapsed. And out of it, of course, came Hitler. Now, in a very real sense, the Allies could blame nobody but themselves for the appearance of Hitler. But that's not the question. The question is that even Hitler's government performed a service. It brought about economic recovery. it brought about a certain amount of reestablishment of national psychology, and it provided civil order. In spite of the persecution, it did provide a type of civil order. Soviet Russia does the same thing. you can't divorce your wife quite easily in Russia. You can here. So don't go to Russia for a quickie divorce. And if you steal in Russia, the judge doesn't say, well, it's too bad, but you're sociologically deprived, your grandmother beat you up, so I'll let you off. You go to jail. And so on. Mussolini, I'll never forget, an older cousin of mine went to the University of Genoa to study before the war, and when he came back, I asked him how he liked Italy. He said, all right. He said, one thing Mussolini did was make the trains run in time. Well, I was sort of flippant and sarcastic. I said, I can think of a lot cheaper way of doing that. And he didn't like my humor, because he said, well, Mussolini did bring a degree of economic activity and law and order in Italy that had not been true in their way. Now, I'm not upholding Mussolini when I'm Hitler or Stalin. But you see, the worst of governments do maintain a semblance of order, and the anarchy which would ensue would be far worse than a bad government. Now, the powers that be are ordained of God. The next basic point is that the Christian citizen, all citizens, are bound to obey them. Paul was writing to a time when Nero was the emperor at Rome, and he was no angel. Far from it.
What's just the second point you're giving now?
Yeah.
So what is it now?
Christians are bound to obey the government. So are everybody. In other words, that when the Christian disobeys government, he sins. If the unbeliever disobeys government, he compounds his sin.
Are you then taking issue with Schaeffer on that, where he says that, or am I jumping ahead of you?
That's quite right. Take a jump.
Okay, where Schaeffer says that this is true only insofar as the government is obeying God's law.
I agree with Francis Schaeffer.
To the point of the Christian then violating the state.
we have our position from the apostle. Up to the point where the state, the Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, or the Reagan administration, or the Carter administration, I care not what, where the state intervenes and forces Christians to disobey the law of God, that becomes another matter. Now, Calvin held that. Calvin held to the position of peaceful revolution. In Book 4 of the Institutes, he speaks again and again of the peaceful removal of magistrates, as you all well know, at least some of you do. Now, I've never met a magistrate who wanted to be peacefully removed. Of course, you must remember that I can sort of be flip about that, but you must remember in Calvin's day, he was thinking of Geneva, where until 1555 he was not a citizen, but he had such tremendous input that in the elections which got rid of the libertines in Geneva, Calvin's influence cleared the decks and brought in a council of 24, another council of 60, and a council of 100, which were friendly to Calvin's ecclesiastical and civil reforms. So in the situation in which Calvin wrote, that made more sense than you might think. On the other hand, when you go to John Knox in Scotland, you have a different situation, where he and Mary Queen of Scots did not get along, and where he told Mary Queen of Scots, "Cursed be the kingdom whose ruler is a queen." That endeared him to her. But you see, Mary Queen of Scots had no intention of getting off the throne because of John Knox. None at all. And of course, Queen Elizabeth intervened, and she was removed from the throne at the chopping block.
Wasn't the situation that Daniel was in the government?
Yes.
Would be a good example?
Yes. Bowing, praying towards Jerusalem. There have been many illustrations, the Covenanters. the Huguenots in France. No, this history still is a good example. I agree with Francis Schaeffer on that point. But even then, there should be a consensus among the Christians as to where that point has been reached. And even then, according to Calvin, you should first pray and then make every intelligent effort, meaningful effort, to peacefully remove the magistrates in question. Now, there might be a time to go with Francis Schaeffer when the situation gets so desperate that some sort of armed revolution might be necessary, as the Covenanters found out in Scotland, following Knox's example. But, you see, the Christian cannot take the law into his own hands, period. I think Christians who refuse to pay their taxes are sinning. Because what they can do, then anybody else can do, and you would bring the government into anarchy.
Suppose they go one step further, begin taxing the church.
Well, then I think the church should not pay it. Because that's invading the sovereignty of the church.
They think they're
sovereign. This is the clash of sovereignty. At that time, what we need is John Knox to stand up and be the trumpet of the Lord and preach the sovereignty of God. What we need is an Admiral Coligny is in France, the great Huguenot leader in France.
Or, there'd be a real moral problem, for instance, it bothers me a great deal that some amount of tax money is used to pay for abortion.
It bothers me terribly.
But you still feel we should pay it anyway. I'll be being forced past the point that you're speaking of.
I think so, because to begin with, the tide is turning against abortion. And I think that that they've drastically reduced the payments in North Carolina. I don't know about Georgia, but North Carolina, they have. Much of this disconcerting reactions of our sociologists. Now, have I made myself clear in this?
Thank
you. Always, the floor is yours.
I understand what you're saying, but I can't figure out anything good about Idi Amin.
Well, let me put this, he's not my great hero.
I thought about that so much, you know, before even we're supposed to obey the government.
Well, one thing we forget. In our obedience to an evil government, the church glows with a glowing testimony. I never forget what the contemporary said and what James Anthony Froude made so very clear in his History of England, that as powerful as Cranmer was in England with his preaching, with the 49 Articles Act, 42 Articles Act, and the prayer book, and with all the people who were led to Christ through his efforts, His greatest testimony was his burning at the stake. Actually, Froude said that he brought more people to the Lord by his death than he brought by his life. What?
With his martyrism.
With his martyrism, burning at the stake, yeah.
That's all through history, though.
That's. Yeah, the Christians who fed the lions at the Saturday afternoon matinees in Rome were responsible for the conversion of X number of Romans.
I think one thing about this thing with Idi Amin, I think as far as his for his writings was because the church in Uganda was in a terrible backslidden condition.
It was a terrible state, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Before his writings.
Before. And I think we could say the same of Nebuchadnezzar. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't see, but he was used as the instrument of God to awaken, to chasten his children into awakening. And today, a revival is going on.
I think there's a point here to be observed. The Lord often uses such people as Idi Amin to bring judgment upon church. Therefore, as our text will tell us, we are not to resist the rulers, for they are not terrors to those who do evil, good, but those who do evil. Thus, there's another question that comes up, and the scriptures here are quite clear, that when the Lord sends evil rulers, they are not only a judgment upon the nation very often, but they're a judgment upon the church in that nation, because a national decline, a national corruption, generally follows the corruption of the church. And thus, the church is the cause of the national corruption, of which the Lord punishes by judgment. Therefore, we are not to resist God's punishment. Now, that may be brave words, but when you come to Romans 13, we have to face this text. For instance, verse 4, for he is the minister of God unto the good. But if you do evil, if you do the good, fear him. But if you don't, if you do evil, fear him. For he is the minister of God for wrath's sake. Now, if you go through this text, I'm reading out the Greek, and I know that you understand it, but what does this mean? That the state must enforce the law of God. He's the minister of good. Now, what is good? In the scriptures, the ethical concept of good is not subject to the popular vote. It's not the product of impersonal natural law. It's not the result of sociological quibbling or such a psychological twaddle. That which is good is that which is of God. The law is the revelation of the righteousness and the holiness and the justice of God. Therefore, the law must be enforced because he's the minister of the good. Now, what do we mean by the good? What encompasses it? It means the Ten Commandments. That's the supreme revelation of what is good. The ceremonial law was only an aid to worship. The ceremonial law without the Ten Commandments would have been of no effect. The civil law of Israel without the Ten Commandments would have been something on paper without any means of enforcing it, but with no moral and ethical background against which to enforce that law.
I don't mean to pick and choose.
Please do.
But what would be different than that, than what we're saying today, as far as some can apply and some can't apply? Aren't we in fact saying what you just said?
I was following the Westminster Confession of Faith, where it says, In chapter 19, that we are bound, both believer and unbeliever, we are bound by the moral law. And then they're going to exempt the ceremonial law because it was fulfilled in Christ, and the civil law because it came to an end when the nation of Israel came to an end in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple. But you need to know that the civil law for Israel came to an end when the temple was destroyed. The civil law and the ceremonial law, and at exactly the same time.
How much of our Constitution reflects the law of God?
Well, that's not the question, Bill Engine. See, a great many people, and I'm not picking on you, at least just for this moment. Constitutional law does not embody statutory legislation. The Constitution is a directive as to how the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branches of the government shall conduct themselves. There's a tremendous difference between constitutional law and common law and legislative enactment. Now, it sets forth in chapter Article 3 the powers of Congress. 17 powers of Congress denotes what Congress can do. It denotes what the President can do and what he can't do. It denotes what the court shall be. Now, thus, the question is not what does the Constitution reflect so much, what does it contain, what it reflects. It reflects a solid conception of biblical law. It does not, in and of itself, contain biblical law. But it provided for congressional enactments, legislation. It provided for statutory laws in the states which would embody that biblical law. Now, in the form of the government, it reflects the Presbyterian General Assembly. In the concept of law, it reflects the biblical doctrine, not the content, but the concept. The Constitution reflects the concept of law, and the legislative enactments are supposed to reflect the content of biblical law. Do you get my difference? The Constitution reflects the concept of biblical law, whereas the legislative assemblies are to reflect the content of biblical law.
Would an example of that be like the commandment says thou shalt not steal?
Yeah.
But what happens when you steal? The scripture says, you know, you're to give that back plus interest,
so we
put him in prison.
Yeah.
So there's an ability to change things around there, the basic law is the same?
Basically, prison is not a biblical remedy for the whole most part. And the Bible prescribes restitution.
Somebody said they didn't have jails in Israel until the monarchy was set up.
I don't know if I had them then, to tell you the truth. Did they, Bill? No, England had that. What a foolish idea. A man is bankrupt and can't pay his debt, so they put him in jail. How in the world can you pay your debts in jail?
Take license
plates. Well,
yeah.
Well, what they did, they shipped them to colony, particularly to Georgia.
Georgia. The first penitentiary in this country, it really isn't all that old, you know.
No.
The idea was that they would put these people in a penitentiary and they would become penitent.
That's what the word comes from.
Yeah.
The penitential system of the Roman Church.
And they believed that they would actually be better citizens after, you know, being in the penitentiary than they...
Well, it's no more foolish than the idea of the modern prison system whereby a restoration, where 75% go back to crime again.
Reconstruction.
Yeah. Now, have I made my point very clear? I'm trying to answer the question now. I haven't come close, I realize. But the government is ordained to enforce the law. It's ordained to reward the righteous or those who obey the law and to punish those who don't. It's ordained to enforce the whole of the Ten Commandments. That means the first four.
Can we go to a practical part of that?
Yeah.
What about the, which we discussed earlier, the Sabbath commandment?
All right. Do you believe? I get it in Salisbury, North Carolina, when the Southern, what to be the Southern Railway, ran trains, or they prohibited them from running through Salisbury on the Sabbath day. Nothing moved. Yeah?
I think I know what you're going to say. When is it proper to amend the law?
Which law?
I guess that's the question I'm asking. Which law needs to be amended?
What law are you talking about?
Well, as far as in the government.
Well,
we just voted on a bunch of constitutional amendments.
In Georgia?
Mm-hmm. Is it proper to do that?
Yes. The federal constitution has an amending clause. Now, it's supposed to be used with great caution and great care. Because the Philadelphia Convention realized it was not infallible, and they already promised to have the Bill of Rights amended to it. So that, when a constitution becomes subject to amendment when the thing being amended shouldn't have been there in the first place. and you begin to treat your constitution like a statutory legislation.
Yeah, well, that's one problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know in this state, the constitution, the state constitution, actually incorporates a great many statutes into it. It's not the basis of it. Incorporates statutes into it. If it does that, I think so. It can be amended in a sense like a plebiscite, frankly.
Well, it seems to me like people are using it to amend the Constitution. Yeah.
They had all the carpetbaggers and all down here, and so they changed their concept.
Mm-hmm.
They came up with this type.
They rewrote the Constitution in 1867.
Right.
Well, they've written that 20 times.
Well, you're talking about. Now, let me say this very frankly. I don't agree with Jesse Helms on the proposed prayer amendment. I'll tell you why. A prayer amendment has no place in the federal constitution or any other constitution. It should be statutory. Now, in the same way, I don't approve of an amendment for abortion, because abortion. The prohibition of abortion should be a statutory legislation. And
the only reason he probably holds that in is because it's the only way he knows how to override the
statute. Well, I know that, because I know Jesse quite well personally, and I have known him. But I still don't agree with him. Now, what you're saying is the end justifies the means. Now, you see, I'm going to give you case in point. The 18th Amendment was a terrific mistake. Have I shocked you?
No.
The reason is very simple. To prohibit a man from drinking may be a very valid thing in state statutory legislation, but it has no place in the Constitution. None at all. And when you do that, the tragedy of the 18th Amendment was it opened up for a way for a lot of other amendments that have no place in there either.
So going back to my question with the Sabbath, should we be then, as Christians, advocating going back to the blue laws? And
yeah, there's nothing blue about the blue law. They were all holy. What made our nation great? What we are today or what we were when those laws were enforced? Answer the question, and don't duck me. You see, now you think, boy, what a reactionary you have in your hands. But if people observe the Sabbath day the way they should, we'd be much better off. Another thing, what follows the Sabbath day as a commandment? The fifth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which Lord thy God giveth thee. Am I right? Thank you. There's a sequence here. No false worship. Worship the true God. Do not take his name in vain. On the Sabbath day, honor your parents. Now, you see, oftentimes people call the firstborn the last six. I'm not sure about that, because the family is divinely established. And the fifth commandment is a connecting link between the firstborn and the last five. And when you see, when we have what we have today in the destruction of family, divorce, the misuse of wives, which is a bad, terrible thing, and the abuse of children, which is worse because they're so helpless. You see, where'd that come from? I made the remark, I think, at the beginning of this course, that the solution to the problem, if it would be accepted, is this: the return to covenant theology. Covenant theology places a proper emphasis upon God, upon his name, upon his day, upon the family, upon the properties of sex, upon property, covetous and whatnot, upon human life, the prohibition against murder. It all stems to the fact that the creation mandate for man to be a good steward of his life, his liberty, his property, to be God's prophet, priest, and king in society. No other theology teaches this. They teach it parts of it, but they do not teach it as a consistent whole, nor do they teach it in the light of a consistent theology. You see, I hate to use the word because it has a bad connotation, a bad odor in my thinking. driving down this morning on Highway 85, somebody very thoughtlessly had connected with a skunk. And while the skunk was dead, his memory lived on. See, the disregard of the Sabbath day brings tremendous ills in its wake. The fifth commandment suffers. Children not trained the way they should be. The sixth, the seventh, the eighth, the ninth, and tenth commandments suffer. And when you disregard or misuse the first three commandments, then the fourth and the fifth, the sixth, and the ninth suffer. The commandments are intrinsic whole. They're not piecemeal. You can't say, I won't blaspheme the Lord's name. I wouldn't think of it. But I just cut it. Or I'll count my beads. Or something like that. children provoke, parents provoke not your children to wrath. The covenant father remembers that his children are part of his stewardship. Now, there's a very grave danger in this popular rush to child abuse that this will be used to further reduce the biblical nature of the family, and that the social agencies, always lusting for power, always grasping for something by which they can wreck society, will rush in and try to take control. If I were a college president, I would not allow any sociology to be taught in my college. I would be very, very careful. I might allow a couple of courses in psychology, but I would throw sociology out completely. It was conceived in sin and born in iniquity, and an abomination unto the Lord, and all sound thinking people. It is the illegitimate study. It was born of illegitimate parentage, fathered and nurtured by August Comte for the desecration of the human race and the abolition of the church. Read August Comte's Positive Philosophy if you don't believe me. 1831, Paris. Right? Thanks. Now, have I covered this tonight? I'm pretty much done, but have I really answered your questions? Oh. Don't perjure yourself.
let me just see if I've got this. Really, then, what we should be doing as Christians in this whole area of law and politics, should we not be doing two things? Educating the church as to what God's law truly is, and then advocating it very much within the political system to those who are in power and those who really maybe we should be putting in power.
Right. You see?
In other words, we really failed this way.
The average member of Congress is a man of rather low mentality and low morality, a feeble understanding, and not very well informed. The average of the state legislature is generally lower than that. I hate to turn this off.